Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for joining us as we talk a little more about the hobby that we love, baseball cards, with a focus on the junk wax era. Although, if you are a longtime listener of the program, you know that we like to diverge from the 80s and 90s cards often, and we will be doing that in future shows. I will explain in just a few minutes. First of all, on this episode, we will break into two of three cello packs that we offered up for your bidding earlier in the week. And this was another epic struggle of tough choices to make. Of course, we put these on Twitter, and the Twitter polls, you can only get one vote. So even though the top two packs of the three or four that we put up for your selection get opened on the program, you can only pick one. And I thought last week's battle between the packs from 1990 and 91 was interesting in that the 1990 score pack was one of the ones that was opened as opposed to 90 Fleer or 91 Leaf. Well, this week, I know it was very tough for a lot of our listeners to choose from 86 Tops, 84 Fleer, and 87 Tops. Because 87 Tops is one of the most loved cards in baseball card history. I do know of a few people that don't like it. Yes, it's true, there are some people that don't like 87 Tops. But it's few and far between. I'd have to say probably 95% of people who collect baseball cards love 87 Tops. Yet, 87 Tops finishing number three in the voting. No surprise, 84 Fleer runs away with the top number of votes. They got 52% of the vote. But 86 Tops gets 28%. 87 Tops gets 20%. So we get to open up the 86 Tops and 84 Fleer, and I'll open up 87 Tops some other time. But two interesting sets, different types of sets that we're going to get a peek at today when we open up those packs in a little bit. 84 Fleer is one of my favorite sets of the 80s. It is one of my favorite sets from the year of 1984, which was a great year for baseball cards, as not only did you have a lot of hits with rookies and stars, a lot of the players who would make great memories for us when we were kids growing up in the 1980s, you not only had that crop of talent to pull from, but 1984 was the year that all three card companies, Topps, Fleer, and Donruss, really got their act together. And they put out some of their best product that year. And I think all three companies would do that for the next few years, actually. I think you're in a golden age of the 1980s from, you know, I think you include 1983. 83 Donruss wasn't that great. It was better than what they had put out in 81 and 82. But really, from 84 to 87, or 83 to 87, you could say, really just every card company was just cranking out some great stuff, not just in design, but again, talent and rookie cards and just a lot of really good stuff that you could still get at good prices nowadays, ridiculously good prices in some cases. But, you know, 84 Fleer was the first year that Fleer really went in the right direction. 83 Fleer was pretty good. It was certainly much better than 82 Fleer, but 84 Fleer, you know, the design was nice, the colors were clean, the cardboard stock was good. Photography still needed a little bit of work. You know, there were still some blurry and grainy pictures, but a far cry from what Fleer had introduced in 1981. So 84 Fleer, we'll look into that, enjoy that set, as well as 86 Tops, which I am now starting to collect with a little more veracity. Couple reasons why. One is, as I have picked up rather cheaply packs or old vending boxes of a lot of cards from the mid to late 80s and early 90s, I have suddenly found a fixation, a crusade, if you will, to build out sets and complete them. Not to sell them, because, you know, a hand-collated 87 Tops set is maybe valued at $15, and, you know, it's 87 Tops, you can get it everywhere. But just for some reason, I've realize that I've got all these cards. Well, let me just put them together, see if I can get a complete set, and just, you know, complete sets. And, you know, I've done that with 87 tops numerous times. I started doing it with 89, 90, and 91 tops. Now there's 88 tops, and now there's 86 tops. So 86 tops have come around. I was never totally in love with that set. I think Fleer and Donruss outdid tops in 1986 in terms of product quality. But 86 tops is one that I've come back around to. We're going to open that up. And also, I've noticed that you're starting to see a new demarcation point in 1980s baseball cards. I've mentioned this before. There's been a demarcation in the era from 1979, 80, 81. If you're trying to find vintage wax in particular, you know, the unopened wax packs, sometime over the past couple years, the market just jumped. And unopened wax packs from that time, you used to be able to get 79, 80 tops for, you know, $12, $15, depending on where you were getting them from. Well, now all of a sudden, it's $20, $25 for a pack. And that kind of drags 81 tops and 82 tops and 83 tops. You know, the price goes up a little bit. You're starting to see another demarcation between 1985 and 86. And that's not a surprise, because as the hobby grew and as it grew into more of a business and an industry, you have more cards being printed in 1986 and moving forward into what we call the junk wax era. So 86 tops, and to a point, Donruss and Fleer, are still pretty affordable and easy to find. You're starting to see those price hikes in the early 80s packs, and you're still seeing that price hike in the late 70s. So it's another kind of fracture in the generation of baseball cards there, and I want to try to get my hands on 86 tops while they're still plentiful, because there will be eventually, whether it's because people are just throwing them out, we open up our collections and find damaged cards, eventually 86 tops will start moving up in price just a little bit. Certainly not to a rarity point, but to a point where you can't buy the packs for a dollar a piece anymore. They'll start nudging up over the next few years. Now, let's take a look at some upcoming content, not just in today's show where we open up the 86 tops and 84 Fleer cellos, and also talk about why kids are not getting into the hobby and how you can improve it. And we had some great conversation over the past few days on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. But in upcoming shows, we will be doing some more pack breaks. Normally, I don't tell you what we're going to be doing next week, but I'll give you the heads up. After that very tough choice between packs from 84, 86, and 87, we're going to take our medicine next week. We're going to force ourselves to open two packs of cards from 1988. And 1988 is not only, speaking of demarcation points, where a lot of people think that the junk wax era started, but the designs of a lot of the 1988 cards are certainly not as good as what we saw in previous years, although there are some gems out there. So we will be offering up a pack of 88 tops, 88 Donruss, 88 Fleer, and 88 Score. And in fact, I believe the Donruss and Score packs are rack packs. The Fleer and Tops packs will be cello packs. So we're going to take our medicine. We're going to look back at one of the not-so-great years in card collecting, but a pivotal year nonetheless, because a lot of people were getting into the hobby then, and the hobby was certainly changing right before our eyes. So even though you could say that 1988 was the beginning of the junk wax era, it was also in many stretches the end of innocence, you know, with Score coming on board. Now you had four companies. And then, of course, in 1989, you had Bowman and Upper Deck getting introduced. And then all the premium cards start coming around a couple of years later. So this may be the end of the innocence, to quote Don Henley, as we look back at 1988. We're going to do that next week's show. And then moving forward from there, We will be looking back at some older cards, much to the delight of a lot of our longtime listeners. I was at a baseball card show this past weekend here in Tampa, and I was pleasantly surprised with the amount of vintage, and I'm not talking 1978, we're talking 1940s and 50s cards that were not only for sale, but at a very, very affordable price. Now, as I've mentioned in shows before, I am not a stickler for card condition when it comes to just getting old cards. Now, if I'm going to go out there and purchase a 56 Topps Jackie Robinson, you better believe I want as good of a condition as possible if I'm going to sink that much money into it. But just for a stack of cards, as long as the card is not destroyed, I'll take it. And I found one particular vendor at this card show who was selling a lot of cards from the late 40s and early 50s that were already half off whatever they were priced at. And since some of these cards were in basically excellent condition or less, the price is already way down from what you could get from, the book price or if you, went through PSA. So I ended up buying a ton of cards from this era for a dollar a piece or $2 in some cases. So over the next few episodes, we will, with our pack breaks, we will mix in the cards that I picked up here. We've got some from 1951, 52, 53, 54 Bowman, 55 Bowman as well. Also, I did pick up one card each. And it's because I didn't want to blow my budget. It's very easy to do at these types of shows. But the next time I go out to the show, if it's not next month, it might be a little closer to the fall, I will pick up some of the 53 and 52 Topps cards, a few more. But I do have one card from 52 Topps, one card from 53 Topps. I added a few more 54 and 57 Topps to my collection. And finally, I have some 55 and 56 Topps cards to call my own. So we will put a spotlight on those particular sets. Again, it won't happen in a string. We'll do a pack break 1 week. We'll do some vintage cards the next week and just kind of alternate back and forth. Funny story about those vintage cards. There was one card in particular that I had to buy, even though the condition wasn't too great. You could flip it over. It was a 51 Bowman. Or was it 51 Bowman, I believe. And, you could tell by the back of the card that this was a card that somebody had glued into a photo album, which was not all that uncommon of a practice back in the day. There's a little bit of damage on the back of the card, but the front is in pretty good shape. And it's for a player from the Phillies whose name was Dick Whitman. Now, other than, the childish snickering that you may have over getting that baseball card of a guy named Dick, if you are a fan of Mad Men, you know all about Dick Whitman. According to the plot, the series plot, Dick Whitman was the birth name of our protagonist, Don Draper. And if you recall the storyline, Dick Whitman during World War II, he had a fellow soldier by the name of Don Draper. Don Draper gets killed. In fact, it's friendly fire, if I recall correctly. And because of Dick Whitman's very shady, weird past, he basically takes the dog tags off of the deceased Don Draper. And at that moment, assumes the identity of Don Draper and 20, 25 years later, where the series takes place, he's basically living this second life, which he got from, the loss of life of Don Draper. So I found that extremely entertaining. And for a dollar, I got to buy the Dick Whitman 51 Bowman card. So that'll be one of the fun things that we get to look at. Also, I will, over the next few weeks, try to work in a couple of guests over the phone. One is Fred Harris, who, as we mentioned in last week's show, is one of the authors of The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book, a book written back in the early 70s when the hobby was still very much a hobby. And it's a book that I'm eventually going to get my hands on, but from what I've read, it is very reminiscent to what you may have seen in Cardboard Gods, you know, basically looking at baseball cards and just having this irreverent conversation about the players, the names, the cards themselves. So Fred was actually the person who sparked our conversation a couple weeks ago about why kids are not collecting. So we will connect with him at some point in time over the next few weeks. Also, I have reached out to a gentleman named Michael Chapman who follows us. He actually reached out to me a long time ago, like a year and a half ago, and was telling me the story about how his dad was a salesperson for Topps back in the late 70s and early 80s. He would go on to work for Score when they launched in 1988, also worked for the company that produced Big League Chew bubblegum. So we're reaching out to him. Again, this was like a year and a half ago when we first touched base. He said, oh, yeah, you should be on the show. And it just never happened. But hopefully we can get him because I'm sure there are a lot of great stories of having the baseball card guy living in your house. He's your father. And he also mentioned in some back and forth that he and his older sister were treated to boxes and boxes of baseball card treats and bubblegum throughout the years. So hopefully we can get him on the show as well. So that's what's coming up over the next several weeks. Again, the Wax Ecstatic podcast, I've got a little free time over the summer. We can do it. And while I don't know the frequency of the program going into the fall when things pick up a little more intensely for me at my work in the National Hockey League, we're going to have some fun over the next few weeks. So make sure you get the word out to your friends that Wax Ecstatic is coming your way. Fridays, noon Eastern is when we post the show. We also post the video link to the pack breaks if you want to watch the pack breaks, or you can listen to them. And by the way, this week I have changed our little microphone arrangement here in my studio. So hopefully the sound quality on the audio side of the pack break does not take a step back like the previous few episodes had. I think we've got that fixed. So we'll find that out a little later on when we go to open up the packs. But the program comes your way on Fridays. It is available via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio. Also, TuneIn. You can find us on Blueberry, Stitcher, you name it. If it's a program that hosts podcast, it's probably out there. And we always encourage you to pass along the Twitter handle Wax and Gum Stains. That is our Twitter handle that is open 24/7, and we certainly enjoy a lot of the conversation that is out there. And also your questions and comments, too. We like to touch up on those during every episode. And lastly, a quick plug for our PayPal account, paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you have made donations, thank you very much. I appreciate it. If you haven't, if you find it in your heart, even if it's just a couple dollars, and that's what a lot of the donations have been, $10 or $15 or less, and that is perfectly fine. As I point out during every show, I don't do this for money. Yes, you can make money doing podcasts, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of listeners to do it. And while I'm appreciative of the audience that we have here, we're not quite at printing money stage yet. So any cash donations are greatly appreciated. Where does that money go? Not to my pocket. It actually goes to the well-being of this program on two fronts. One, there are some production costs that go into this, basically our subscription with Audio Boom and the maintenance of our archive. It's all up there and you know, connecting things to iTunes and everything else. There is also a sweat equity that I put in. It takes 2 or 3 hours to put together each show. So it's good to know that a few pennies are kind of going my way. But more importantly, the purchasing of packs. If you want to see us open up some packs and hopefully some better packs as time goes on, this is the way to do it. So if you have a small donation, like I said, even if it's just a few bucks, you can make it at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And one of those donations, my thanks to Steve Bowman, our friend in Buffalo, Waxpack 916, who took the lot of vintage cards off my hand. I was talking about them in last week's show. It wasn't 80 cards. I don't know where I came up with 80. It was actually 92 cards. But Steve took home a collection of cards, which was mostly 78, 79, but quite a few cards from 1973 and 74 in there. Also a handful of cards from 1968 and 71. So Steve will be adding to his ever-growing collection of vintage. And I thank you very much, Steve, for doing that. Now, before we open up the 84 Fleer and 86 Top Cellos, let's talk about how and why kids are not collecting. Better yet, how we can fix it. And after spending a lot of time last week talking about why kids are not involved in the hobby as much, and you know, there's a lot of great reasons that we discussed, my challenge to you was, well, what can you do about it? Because we all know why the hobby took a few steps back, and it is making a comeback. But, you know, it's certainly not anywhere near where it was 25 or 30 years ago. And as I warned you in last week's show, it probably won't ever be that way again, which could be a good thing, could be a bad thing. But the hobby is alive and well. You know, we're not talking about an endangered industry like, you know, the newspaper industry in terms of, you know, print newspapers. You know, we're not talking about the cable industry in terms of, you know, getting that video quality content from a cord in your wall. You know, we're not talking about an industry that is just dying on the vine. This is something that, you know, a lot of self-inflicted wounds have caused this problem for the baseball card industry and Major League Baseball by extension. So knowing that there are a lot of forces outside of our control that have caused this problem, how can we as collectors, as fans of the hobby, as fans of the game, how can we fix it? So we set up some parameters. We posted this on Wax and Gum Stains a little earlier in the week. So how can you help get more kids collecting cards? Tell us with the following parameters. One, Topps is still the only exclusive card company. Again, Topps just recently had their exclusive agreement with Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association extended through 2025. So we know that for at least the next 7 years, anybody's hopes of having a revival of Fleer or Donruss or Upper Deck doing baseball cards ain't happening. It just isn't. Now, there are still all of the other brands under the Topps umbrella, including Archives and Opening Day and Bowman Chrome and Stadium Club and you name it. So there's still plenty of options, but it's not going to be made by anybody not named Topps, at least the officially licensed stuff. Parameter number two, prices of packs aren't coming down. Assume they stay the same. A lot of people were saying that the price of buying packs or sets is a big reason why kids are not doing it, and I absolutely agree. But again, this is out of our control. You know, if you're Topps and you're signing exclusive deals through 2025, and you're still selling packs of cards at $2 a piece for the base set and then a few dollars more for other sets, then the model is clearly working. So if the model is working, then that means they're not lowering prices to 50 cents a pack like in the good old days. So we can't sit there and try to dictate the market on price point. And then last but not least, our parameter, you can't go back in time and avoid the 94 strike. That is, even though it wasn't cited in a lot of our comments last week, it is, in my opinion, that is a continuing albatross in Major League Baseball's existence. And even though baseball has rebounded rather well, and I know that there are some crises going on, including pace of games and, you know, lower TV ratings in some markets, and certainly attendance has been raised as an issue, you know what? There's the whole problem of having an entire generation, our generation, those of us, you know, the Gen Xers, those of us in our mid to late 30s and who have just passed the 40 plateau. You know, a lot of us, we stopped watching. And if you stop watching, you stop collecting. If you stop collecting and watching, you stop caring. And some of us, such as myself, we came back to it. Took 15 or 20 years, but we did. Some people, not so much. And, you know, if you're of this age, you probably have kids, and maybe you're not teaching your kids about the hobby or about the sport. And that is something that has certainly hampered the hobby. So those are the parameters. Topps is still the lone exclusive maker. Prices of packs aren't changing. And we can't play revisionist history. You know, we're working with the cards that we've been dealt. And we had a lot of great suggestions. So I'm just going to go in chronological order here. Kevmo K21 had a rather lengthy response, but let me boil it down to this. The hobby is strong and will be strong as long as adults get their kids into baseball. What should change is getting the Topps flagship set in more stores. When we collected in the 70s or 80s, the packs were available in every local pharmacy, grocery store. Yes, and this is something that I brought up last week, Kev, a great idea. There's not as many outlets for cards. You know, local card shops, which are the lifeblood and will bring in the heartiest of fans and the strongest of collectors, they're very few and far between. There's just not that many, or certainly not as many as there once were. So the cards have to be made available through other means. Walmart and Target are good stores, but if there is a run on cards, i.e. Topps Heritage because of the Ohtani autographs, you know, if I want to buy some cards at Target or Walmart, well, you know, some dealers come in and just wipe the shelves clean. And I'm SOL. I can't get what I want. Now, of course, there's the internet, and the internet's been a game changer in brick and mortar business. I get it. And yeah, you can purchase cards online. A lot of people would prefer to do it that way. But there is something valuable, not just for the collector, but for the retailer, in having the, you know, the point of sale purchase, you know, having that box of cards on the rack by the cash register with all the various candies and lip balms and National Enquirers talking about aliens doing rectal examinations on Hillary Clinton. There is something neat about having those cards right there. So I love the idea of Topps getting product out into, let's say, a Walgreens or a CVS or back into a grocery chain, a Kroger or, you know, a Publix, you know, if you're in the Southeast, or, you know, Albertsons, if you're out West, you name it. So, you know, I would love to see that. I think what complicates it a little bit is what kind of deals does Topps have with Walmart and Target? Because if you've ever bought the blaster packs or the boxes of cards through either of those outlets, you will see that there's the exclusive Target cards, there's the exclusive Walmart cards. So is there some kind of exclusivity in those deals that prohibits Topps from, you know, putting them out in more mainstream grocery stores or drugstores? And then the other thing is getting the retailers to buy in. If you're not aware, retail grocery chains, it's a very competitive business, very slim profit margins. And there is a narrative out there that baseball cards are dead and died a horrible, bloated death in the early 1990s because there was too much product that was out there. And the people who are making decisions at the executive level of grocery chains and drugstores, chances are they were stocking the shelves with the baseball cards 25 years ago and saw that implosion right in front of their own eyes. So it's a very tough sell, I would imagine. Hey, Mr. Grocery Store, we need a little space by your cash register for a you know, desperate purchase of baseball cards that were selling for $2 a pack. It's kind of a hard sell. That's something that Topps would have to approach, but certainly something that could complicate issues. But I love the idea. And I've joked before, I was amazed 2 or 3 years ago when I was at a Bed Bath & Beyond picking up some beach vacation item that apparently you could only get at this store. And amongst all the clutter in front of the cash registers at Bed Bath & Beyond, I saw a box of, and it was open, you know, they were selling the individual packs, of Topps Opening Day. It's like, wait a minute, what's this doing here? But it was a pleasant surprise because you don't see that anymore. So I absolutely love that. And I think if you put the item, again, you know, in front of the cash register or maybe on the candy aisle, you know, that's where the kids are going to be. And, you know, I know my kid wants me to buy every piece of candy that's at the, you know, cash register. Who knows? Maybe you're moving some baseball cards because, you know, they're right there, right in front of you as you're making your purchase. Mike McLaughlin, also known as Coach Mike in my world, he's a fellow coach at my son's Little League. His son plays as well. We were on the same team this past spring. He has a 7-step program, if you will, but actually 7 great points here, which I'll briefly touch on. Number one, get them interested in the sport or sports and players first. Yes, one reason why my son likes baseball cards is when he was 3 or 4 years old, we were watching Tampa Bay Rays games on TV all the time. And we would make the occasional trip to a Tampa Yankees game. They're now called the Tampa Tarpons. And, you know, you got him hooked on the game at a very young age. And he's naturally athletic to begin with, so it wasn't too hard to get him hooked on sports. But when it comes to baseball, you know, getting him to watch games, be it on TV or in person when he was 3 or 4 years old, you know, now it's not just watching Tampa Bay Rays games. It's watching any baseball game, and not just any major league baseball game, minor league, college, you know, you name it, he'll watch it. So that's a great point. Number two, take them to live events. Yep. Just like we discussed. Number three, if you have the ability to get them a personal connection to players, do so. Minor league games offer a lot of opportunity for personal interactions and pick up cards of those players. Yep. You can't always get to a major league game. In fact, I didn't take my son to a major league game, a Rays game, until I think he was 5, maybe 6 years old. But, you know, we're very fortunate here in the Tampa Bay area. We've got a ton of minor league baseball teams around us. But depending on where you live, there may be a minor league team that is not that far of a drive for you. If not minor league, you could take your child to a college game or a high school game. Those are typically free or they're very low price for tickets, you know, $1 or $2 for a ticket. And just seeing the athletes in person, being able to shake hands, being able to get an autograph, or especially in my son's situation, getting a foul ball. My Lord, he'd have a temper tantrum if he didn't get a foul ball. You know, what are the odds? Yeah, there's 50 people sitting in the stands here and the foul ball didn't happen to come your way. But, you know, being able to make that connection to players, and speaking of foul balls, I remember we went to a game in Dunedin where the Blue Jays have their Florida State League team. And there was a catcher. His name is Jorge Saez. He's no longer with the Blue Jays. He's in the Yankees organization now, I think at AA. And after the game, you know, my son's just saying hi to all the players as they're walking down the tunnel into the locker room. And Jorge sees my son and he tosses a ball to him. And that is one of the greatest, you know, connections you can make. And regardless of where Jorge Saez goes in his major league career or life, he's made a fan for life for my son. Number four, be engaged with them in the hobby. Absolutely. If they're going to collect, you should collect as well. And, you know, if you're going to buy yourself a pack of baseball cards somewhere, pick up an extra one for your child and open them up together. That was key, especially early on. You know, I would come home with a couple packs of cards and he would open his, I would open mine, and we'd trade cards back and forth. Number five, start binders of their favorite players or teams. A great idea. In fact, speaking of the Rays, I know my son has separated a lot of his cards. There's a stack of Rays cards, and then there's a box of everybody else. Number six, teach them values with collecting, organization, patience, taking care of your stuff, savings, value of a dollar, etc. Excellent there. first of all, you have some social norms and manners when you're talking about patience, taking care of stuff, organization, but all the other stuff, the economic stuff, you know, this is the stuff we always complain about. Oh, we don't teach economics in high school anymore. Well, probably because you should get that message in their head when they're in second or third grade. They should start learning the value of a dollar. And that's a great point. And I would add to this, you can also utilize baseball cards in terms of, homework almost, you know, basic studies. Tell me how many extra base hits, Derek Jeter got in 2006. Add up the doubles and triples and home runs. You know, you're doing basic math here. You can also do, you know, fun things like, you know, take 10 cards. You know, if you're doing basic math, all right, I've got 10 cards here. You know, what's 10 times 8? Here's 10 cards here. Here's 8 cards there. What is it? You can actually do some extended schoolwork with baseball card collecting. And finally, from Coach Mike, number 7, keep it a hobby. It's meant to be fun. Let it be fun for them. Absolutely. I have never discussed with my son, this card's worth $5. Never. Now, I will, if he pulls a Chase card or something, say, oh, that's a really nice card. Or, ooh, that's a special card, or that's, you know, a really valuable card. But, you know, we don't go online and say, oh, that card's worth $12. Do you want to put it on eBay? No. In fact, I don't care if he doesn't care about the condition of his cards. You know, if he's, got a ding in them or whatever, you know, that's his worries. You know, we're not going to go, oh no, there goes your college savings because you didn't keep this Aaron Judge card properly stored. Make it fun. Let it be fun for them. 29 Collector has a very interesting comment. It's popular, although I don't necessarily agree it's the right way to go. Put gum back in packs. The funny thing is, if I recall correctly, about 10 or so years ago, Topps actually put gum back in the Heritage packs, and they did it the right way. They wrapped the gum in plastic, which is something they should have done a long, long time ago. You know, the gum wouldn't have been the scourge that it was. In fact, the gum may have been a little fresher. You're not opening a pack in June of any given year, and it's already turned rock hard. But I remember buying packs of Heritage going, oh, there's gum, and I'm chewing on it, and I'm going, this is really gross, because it's not because it was hard or crumbly or like the 30-year-old pieces of gum that we pull out of packs these days. But I think, Topps got somebody else to make the gum, and it's sugar-free gum. You know, the gum back in the day was Bazooka Joe, because the Topps Chewing Gum Company made Bazooka Joe gum, and it was actually quite flavorful. Nowadays, not so much. Doug McCready with some interesting comments. One that I want to throw out there is, make the first packs of the year special. I agree in that sense, Doug, in that if you go out and buy your first pack of the year, so, the sets come out in what, late February. So, you buy 3 or 4 packs when they first come out, and, you bring them home to your son or your daughter, hey, it's the brand new baseball cards, and you open them up, and those first packs are special, and it gets them hooked. You know, if they like the cards, if they like the design, they like the players they're getting, then, there's a little added value to them. For that. A couple other comments here. Brave Star Cards. From what I've seen, the kids in my neighborhood are really into the sport, but they are the type of person that might collect too. I love getting kids started with a bunch of cards from my doubles. But he adds that he thinks interest and personality is something that works against it. Yeah, as we mentioned, there's a lot of competing factors to card collecting these days, mostly video games and entertainment on the internet. But getting kids started with a bunch of doubles, if you've got spare cards, we've mentioned Commons for Kids. We actually, I went through a whole bunch of my cards, and we're not just talking about cards from the 80s and 90s, but cards from the last 4 or 5 years, duplicates, and I sent off nearly 3,000 cards to them, and basically the only cost to me is shipping. I was able to fit everything into one whatchamacallit, priority mailbox. So it was about $15 or $16. But that's a small price to pay to free up some space in my room, but also to perhaps introduce some new kids to the hobby. So Commons for Kids is one way that you can, you know, use your duplicates if you're not handing them out to kids you know, just to give them to somebody who can organize that. Also, a great suggestion here from NHL and MLB TTM. Sign them up for Kidority Cards monthly card envelope. It's that easy. Kidority Cards, that's K-I-D-O-R-I-T-Y, and then Cards is spelled with a K, K-A-R-D-S. I was doing a little research. You basically sign them up. You spend $4.50 for a package, and every month they will send you about, I think it's 40 to 50 cards of your child's favorite team. And they also send them out in multiple sports here. So I think that is a great program, Kidority Cards, to get kids interested in cards. And I would also suggest, if you're going to get kids interested in cards, get them while they're young. You know, you got to start them at like 4 or 5 years old before they start getting sucked into the lure of video games and internet games. And there's nothing wrong with your kid playing, you know, Minecraft or, you know, some classic video games online. I mean, there's nothing wrong with your kid playing video games or, you know, watching TV shows on tablets or whatever. I think, you know, obviously with supervision and, you know, knowing that you need to put a limit on what they're watching or how much they're watching, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. But you've got to get cards in their hands when they're 4 or 5 years old, because by the time they get into elementary school and they see kids, you know, playing with tablets and their parents' phones, you know, they get sucked right into it. So getting the cards in their hands when they're 4 and 5, as opposed to just sticking your phone in their hands to keep them entertained, I think is a real big thing here. And then finally, we've got a fun little kicker here from Revolution Sports Card. I've got nothing. The kids are lost. Okay, well, all right. I don't think the kids are lost. And here's why, as I want to put a little capper to this conversation before we open our packs. I mentioned that, you know, I've got a couple of stories of hope to pass along. And like I said, the baseball card industry, while it's not going to go back to a level of participation that it was having 20, 30 or so years ago, I do think it's alive and well because Topps is extending their exclusivity with Major League Baseball. Clearly, the hobby is working. Topps is making money. Baseball and the Players Association is making money. There are collectors out there. That card show that I went to this past weekend, you know, it was at a local flea market. And when you first hear about a card show at a flea market, you kind of go, And I'm even, you know, texting Coach Mike. I'm like, is this worth the drive? And I was very pleasantly surprised because, you know, it was a small show. It's not like back in the day where you had 200 dealers. You had probably 12 or 15. But these are people with great collections, really good stuff at a good value. And you can get new stuff, you can get old stuff, you can get vintage stuff like I did. You had others selling, you know, footballs and autographed baseballs and old pennants, stuff like that. It was nice to see that there were some collectors who not only had a lot of good stuff to sell, but weren't trying to rip you off. You know, they're trying to keep the hobby alive as well with some pretty good deals. So there's hope there. But when it comes to kids collecting, two signs of hope. One was at this card show where I brought my son, Coach Mike brought his son, and the people that were there, you know, it was, you know, there were probably 30 or 40 customers just kind of floating around table to table. But as you had customers coming in and going out, it wasn't your stereotypical, you know, comic book store guy from The Simpsons customer. Yeah, you had a few of those. You know, you had some people coming around going, you know, 82 Fleer, worst card set ever. Yeah, you had that. But you had a lot of kids. And kids of all ages, you know, not just the 8 and 9 year olds like we were bringing, but I saw some teenagers. I saw, you know, a whole range of youngsters who weren't getting dragged to the show by their collecting parents. But you could tell that they were interested. They were making purchases as well. And this is on a very small scale. But when you see kids actively at these events and purchasing cards and you know, rummaging through the boxes and, you know, pulling packs out, that's very encouraging. It really is. So even on the small scale of a relatively small card show at a flea market in Tampa, Florida, it gives me some hope because you're being fed this narrative that nobody collects baseball cards. Certainly no kids do, but you can see it yourself. Well, no, they actually do. The other thing that gives me hope, and it's a funny story actually from the Little League team I was talking about, and I didn't intend for this to go this way. It just did. So at the end of the season, after our team's final game, we're having the end of the year party at a local restaurant. And it's kind of a sports bar restaurant. It's called Beef O'Brady's, very family-friendly sports bar, if you will. If you live in the Southeast, you probably have one relatively close to where you live. But we're sitting outside and, you know, the kids are eating their food and the coaches are all, you know, having a beer and talking. And at the end of the meal, you know, the day's gone on pretty long here, and our head coach has a box full of trophies. And he's handing out the trophies to all the kids, you know, and saying all these great things about every kid. So the last trophy is handed out. And I've got with me a little plastic bag with 10 packs of baseball cards. We had 10 kids on the team. And I've done this before where with the baseball team, I would buy each kid a pack of cards. And, you know, at the end of the year, just say, hey, could get a pack of cards. You know, thanks for playing. It's been fun being your coach, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, at the younger ages, it wasn't a big hit. Well, at this particular lunch, the coach hands out all the trophies. Everyone gives themselves a round of applause. And I just, you know, raise up this stack of cards and say, hey, guys, you know, before you go, I've got a pack of baseball cards for each of you. I just want to, you know, thank you for a great season. And the kids practically dropped their trophies on the ground and ran to me for the baseball cards. And I didn't mean to upstage the head coach, but it was really neat for the kids to want these cards. And these are just standard, you know, top space set Series 1 stuff. But it was great to see the kids not only wanting the cards, but as they're opening them up, they're trading them, they're comparing them. They're getting excited if they've got a chase card coming out of the pack. There's also some kids trying to take advantage of other kids' cards. So, you know, all of a sudden I had to turn into a policeman and say, you know, no, you can't have that, you know, Derek Jeter card for the Mikey Matuk card. Sorry, got to be a little more fair. But it was a surprise, and it was offering a little bit of hope that the kids are not all lost. Contrary to popular belief, the hobby is not all lost. That's a very good sign too. But it's good to see that when you offer it up and it's just a $2 pack of cards, hey kids, come get your cards before you go. I mean, they loved it. So when you've got kids, and granted they're playing on a little league team, so they're already invested in baseball, they know about it. But we know there's a lot of distractions, not just, you know, their game schedule, but the video games that they could be playing, the other things that they could be doing with their spare time. But the fact that they were just thrilled to get a free pack of baseball cards and then open them up and share them and trade them, that was very encouraging. So I think as we kind of wrap up the conversation over the past couple of weeks over why kids are not collecting, I think it's on us as collectors to find ways to engage them. And we had a lot of great suggestions that we went through. I would, in closing, say if you have kids, get them collecting when they're young, get them interested. With that said, there's never too late of an age to get them interested. You know, I've told the story. I was 11 years old when I started collecting. Some people are late bloomers in the hobby, but, you know, it's never too late to get them involved. But, you know, get them involved as early as possible. Make every pack special. you know, make it a bonding time between you and your children. And when I say children, I don't just mean boys. Get the girls involved too. You know, there's nothing wrong with getting your young daughter involved in collecting in the hobby. Some of the most feverish sports fans, especially in hockey, but you know, baseball too. Hey, the girls like their sports as well. All right. It's not all Barbie dolls and princesses here. So, you know, get your sons and daughters involved, make it fun, make it a hobby, keep it a hobby. Don't make it a, you know, a store, but, get them involved, have some fun with it, do some creative things with it. And then the other thing is, if you don't have children of your own, maybe you're not married, maybe you're too young, you do have ways to connect to children. You can donate those extra cards. I would recommend, again, Commons for Kids, doing something like that. It's not looked upon as well as it used to, just drop off cards at a kid's hospital or whatever. If you want to do that, call ahead, see if the if they actually can use these cards, and you know what they, you know, how is there a limit, how many can they take. But you know, also feel free to you know, donate them to a cousin or a nephew or niece of yours, or you know, bring them to a youth group at church or whatever. I mean, there's different ways to get people involved with them, is what I'm saying. So it's up to us, because, you know, we don't run the Topps company. We don't set the prices. We don't, you know, unless you do work in wholesale buying for a grocery chain, we can't determine exactly where the cards are going to be in the store. So it's really up to us to continue the love and the passion of the sport and the hobby and pass it on to the next generation. Baseball card collecting and Major League Baseball is going to have to deal with that missing generation of Gen Xers and our kids, you know, for those of us that didn't come flocking back to the game. You also have to deal with the indifference from the millennials, and that is also part of a trickle-down effect from the baseball strike in 1994. So it's not an easy path to get kids collecting, but it's there. It's just really going to be on us as collectors to keep our kids, to get them involved and keep them involved as well. So a great discussion. Thank you for your participation, not only with pointing out why kids are not collecting, but also offering up some very valuable suggestions as to how to get them into the hobby and hopefully keep them into the hobby for a very, very long time, so they're passing it on to their kids many, many years from now. Well, let's pass along some 84 Fleer and 86 Topps. Let's rip open into these packs, shall we? So we have our three packs for this week. We've got 86 Topps, 84 Fleer, and 87 Topps. Now, I knew that the 84 Fleer pack was going to be one of the two packs just because, well, it's the oldest of the three. A lot of collectors like looking at the older packs, and also there's some bigger hits in terms of rookie cards or second-year cards. So no surprise, that led the voting with 52%. Favoring that one. So I'm going to set that aside. We're going to open that second. I'm a little surprised, though, with 86 Topps and 87 Topps, because 87 Topps is pretty popular with fans. But it was 86 Topps that wins the second place vote, getting 28% of the total vote compared to 20% for 87 Topps. So the 87 Topps, maybe a lot of collectors are just used to opening them. I don't know what it is, but trust me, I will open this up. I'm still four cards shy of completing a set, so I'll see if I can gather a few in there. But let's take a look at 86 Topps and 84 Fleer. So our 86 Topps cello pack is going to be first. As you can see, the Gary Carter All-Star card on top, the late kid of the Montreal Expos. As we open this up, of course, we've got the splendid bubblegum stuck to our spring training contest card, and also leaving a bit of a gum stain here, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Jack Morris, what do you know? Let's actually start with that one. We'll move the kid to the middle of the pack here. Jack Morris, we actually did our podcast on 86 Topps on him. Great to see him in the Hall of Fame. I know some people will argue that he shouldn't be, but really good to see Jack Morris, who was definitely in his prime here in 1986. Next, we've got Craig Reynolds of the Houston Astros, Rick Manning of the Milwaukee Brewers, good old Tippy Martinez with the Baltimore Orioles. We got Tippy in, I think, the 86 Fleer pack a few weeks back. Terry Harper of the Atlanta Braves, that great red, white, and blue jersey of the 1980s. Gary Renicky of the Baltimore Orioles. Dave Rosema of the Texas Rangers. Murph, once again. Yeah, we got Dale Murphy in the previous episode as well. Was it 86 Fleer? Yeah, I believe so. So Dale Murphy, a big hit in 1986. And also a follower of our Twitter feed, Wax and Gum Stains. And hopefully listening to the show. Big Gorman Thomas, who I made a joke on Twitter recently. He looks like the Sasquatch in Harry and the Hendersons. And he kind of does if you look at it real carefully. The great Rod Carew, another card that we pulled from the 86 Fleer pack a few weeks back. We've got Terry Kennedy of the San Diego Padres. We've got our Padres leader card. Jim Morrison, Light My Fire, another one from that 86 Fleer pack. What is going on with the similar cards? Tom Brookins of the Tigers. We've got that Gary Carter All-Star card, which makes up for the checklist card. Although I have to say, you know, 86 Tops checklist actually looks kind of mean with the black and white, and then you got the red and the yellow too. But still, you know, it's a checklist. That's not the one you're looking for. Vince Coleman, your 85 record breaker for most stolen bases in a season by a rookie with 110. Mike Easler of the Red Sox. We've got Chris Brown of the Giants. Ron Guidry, your all-star card. Here you go, Brett Saberhagen. This was a big dollar card back in the day. His first Topps card as he was a rookie in 1985. And we got another Dale Murphy card, this time the Dale Murphy All-Star card. To counter the Gary Carter All-Star card, we've got the other catcher for the 86 Mets, Ron Reynolds. Rick Waits and Waits and Waits of the Milwaukee Brewers. Bill Lasky of the Montreal Expos. Tommy Hare of the Cardinals, his All-Star card. We've got Tito here, Terry Francona with the Expos, and Dan Quisenberry, the late quizzer of the Kansas City Royals, the one card that is unfortunately stained a little bit from our delectable chewing gum there, but very memorable player, sidearm delivery, automatic, as you can see, leading the American League with 37 saves in 1985, a world championship season for the Kansas City Royals. So some pretty good finds here in 86 Tops. Let's see what we've got in 84 Fleer. Now, Fleer thankfully does not have the bubblegum issue. We do have the legendary Fleer stickers, including the Cincinnati Reds with Mr. Redman in the full windup here. And you've got some detailed stats on the Reds' 83 season. Chicago Cubs with the ball cap and just the nameplate here. And much like the Reds, you've got your 83 stats. Kevin Bass leading off with the Houston Astros. And my son, by the way, calls this Fruit Loops now, which makes me a very happy man. Juan Beniquez of the California Angels. Tommy Hare again of the St. Louis Cardinals, wearing the beautiful powder blue road jerseys that they had back in the days. Nick Isaski with the Cincinnati Reds. A rookie, too. In fact, it almost looks like he's airbrushed here. Either that or they just doctored up his high school picture. But if I recall correctly, Nick Isaski once went on the disabled list with vertigo after he jammed a Q-tip in his ear. Charlie Huff of the Texas Rangers, and I've pointed this out before, the Texas Rangers jersey from 1983, where he had Rangers across the front. It was the double-knit polyester. And the TR logo here, you can't really see it too well. In 1984, the Rangers changed to the Rangers script logo over the state of Texas. They used this up through 1993. But this TR logo was used in 1982 and 83 and only seen on the 83 uniforms. Cesar Cedeno goofing off with the Cincinnati Reds. Ivan De Jesus, also known as that guy the Cubs traded for one Ryan Sandberg. We've got Bruce Benedict of the Atlanta Braves. I love the old Chief Nakahoma logo there. Don Money, then a veteran, longtime infielder for the Brewers, but as you can see here, by 1984, the designated hitter. Got Leon Durham, who would live in infamy in 1984 in the National League Championship Series with his goof against the Padres. Dave Stapleton of the Red Sox. We've got Tim Flannery of the Padres. Look at that great Padre Taco Brown uni as Flannery is just ready to leap out and jump into the batter's box for his turn at the plate. Harold Baines, one of the great underrated players of his time, wearing the beach blanket bingo uniform of 1983 with the White Sox. You could tell at this point in time he was starting to get his career going, but I really think he's underappreciated. Just a really good all-round, I don't want to say utility player, but he started in the outfield. You can move him to first base, designated hitter, played a very long time. Omar Marino of the Yankees, doing his Reggie Jackson impression. If he had a little longer hair on the side, you could argue that that's just an old picture of Reggie. Bruce Kyson of the Angels, Dave Winfield, Seagull Killer of Toronto with the New York Yankees. Steve Renko winding up for the pitch here with Kansas City. We've got Mike Effen Torres, as Red Sox fans would know him, here with the Mets in 1984. Jeff Latida with the Cardinals. Luis Aponte with the awesome curl going there with the Red Sox. Frankie V, Frank Viola. This would be a second-year card for Frank Viola. In terms of money, you're not going to get a lot for this, but I do recall his 83 Fleer for many years was worth a few bucks. But another underrated pitcher. Rick Sutcliffe with the Cleveland Indians, and this is not a rookie card. I believe his Fleer rookie was 1982, but of course would have much more fame and fortune with the Chicago Cubs starting in the mid-80s. Bill Gullickson showing off the tri-colors of the Montreal Expos hat, also the warm-up jacket with Dodger Stadium in the background. Louis Pujols of the Houston Astros. We've got Don Hill muscling out a base hit for the Oakland A's. Good old Robin Yount of the Milwaukee Brewers. Slight little, as you can see, let me see if you can see this here. A little bit of a packaging mistake here. So you got a little indentation on a couple of these cards. So a little bit of wear and tear on the Yount card, but still a very nice one. My favorite player growing up, the Steebster, Dave Steeb. Recently turned, 61 years old. My goodness, wearing those great powder blue uniforms of the Toronto Blue Jays. And we've got Alejandro Pena of the Los Angeles Dodgers on the back. And again, just a little bit of damage to the card there, unfortunately. So some, you know, no big hits here. You know, we're not talking Boggs or Sandberg or, you know, Don Mattingly or Roger Clemens here, but some pretty good hits. A lot of all-stars, a few Hall of Famers as well in both of these packs. So what do you say we pull out some of the bigger names and discuss them just a little bit? All right, a lot of interesting cards from 86 Tops and 84 Fleer. I don't want to spend too much time going through all of these cards because the show is running a little long, but as I mentioned, that 86 Tops pack, so many duplicates from the 86 Fleer pack that we opened up a few weeks ago. Let's see, Dale Murphy, Rod Carew, Jim Morrison, Vince Coleman we had too. That's just kind of odd. Just two different packs of different brands, but a lot of crossover, which is very interesting. All right, some of the highlight cards here. Jack Morris, again, we had the podcast on 86 Tops happened to be about Jack Morris. I highly recommend you listen to that once again as I wax nostalgic about Jack Morris. And why wasn't he in the Hall of Fame? Well, since then, he has been inducted into the Hall of Fame. And that's just tremendous. I really think he is deserved of it. And we talk about how things have changed with pitcher usage, he tried to say. And the days where a guy like Jack Morris could lead the league in complete games with 20 in 1983. Actually, he didn't lead the league. That's right. But 20 complete games. There might be 20 complete games in Major League Baseball this season when it's all said and done in September. Gorman Thomas, not only the Harry and the Hendersons jokes here, but Gorman Thomas was one of those stereotypical, he's either going to hit the ball 3,000 miles or he's going to strike out 3,000 times. You know, in the same pool as Rob Deere and Pete Incaviglia, Dave Kingman, Gorman Thomas was a pretty talented outfielder, mostly for the Brewers, but later on in his career, designated hitter. And, you know, the numbers speak for themselves. Let me look at these career numbers here. 227 average. He had 252 home runs in 1,324 games, but also 1,234 strikeouts. A couple of the All-Star cards here. Gary Carter, the Kid. The late Gary Carter, who, of course, passed away from brain cancer several years ago. You can still hear the pain from Montreal Expos fans. They're still livid that they lost the Expos, but that trade with the New York Mets in 1985. And we were talking a little bit about Gary Carter and that trade when we went through the 86 86 Fleer pack and Floyd Yeomans, who was part of that trade, you know, Hubie Brooks going to the Expos as well. It's the trade that certainly swung the Expos down the drain for a long time. There's three very notable dates and eras in Expos history. One is 1994, of course, the strike wiping out what could have been the Expos' best season in franchise history, a potential playoff team, a potential World Series winner. There was a chance you could have had Montreal and Toronto in the playoffs the same year, which would have been crazy. But that's one. Number two is Blue Monday, when Rick Monday hit the home run off Steve Rogers in Game 5 of the 81 NLCS that helped the Dodgers advance to the World Series, and the trade of Gary Carter to the New York Mets. Another All-Star card here, Ron Guidry, of course, Louisiana Lightning Ron Guidry, who picked up 22 wins, led the American League in wins in 1985, believe it or not. He wrote a great book about basically being the chauffeur for Yogi Berra. And I read that recently. It was a very entertaining book. I highly recommend it. One other All-Star card, talked about it briefly at the end of opening the pack, Dan Quisenberry, 37 saves leading the American League in 1985. That great submarine delivery. He, too, passing away from brain cancer back in, I think it was like 2000, 2001, sometime around there. Brett Saberhagen, one of the great pitchers in that era, the mid to late 80s, he had a very odd track record, though. He would have an outstanding season in odd number years, but then a subpar season in even number years. And this would go on throughout his career. You know, 1985 with the world champion Royals, he goes 20-6 with a 2.87 earned run average. And then his numbers ballooned in 86, then they come down in 87 and back and forth and back and forth. But Brett Saberhagen also, unfortunately, remembered for his shenanigans with the New York Mets in the early 90s. And that was a shenanigan-filled team with him and Vince Coleman, and the late Anthony Young, who also passed away from brain cancer recently. You know, that poor guy just couldn't buy a win, a very talented guy, but he kind of became the face of the hapless Mets in 1993. Terry Francona as a star infielder here with the Montreal Expos. And, you know, it's such an interesting story with Francona, of course, his dad playing in the major leagues, and then Terry becoming a very successful manager, first in the minor leagues. He was Michael Jordan's manager in Birmingham in 1994, and shortly thereafter, moving up the ranks, was managing in Philadelphia, of course, the manager in Boston, when they actually started winning World Series, and now the manager of a very successful Cleveland Indians club. 84 Fleer. Real quickly, I want to read some of the facts on some of the backs of these cards here. So Kevin Bass, did you know he is the cousin of James Lofton, wide receiver for the Green Bay Packers? Tommy Herr, a very underrated infielder. Unless you're a Cardinals fan, you know him very well. It mentions here, he did not go more than two games without getting a hit in 1981 or 82. Now, he wasn't a regular player. He did play over 100 games in each of those seasons, but a very often overlooked part of those great Cardinals teams from the early to mid-80s. Of course, you always think of Ozzie Smith first and foremost, or maybe you're thinking of Ted Simmons or Joaquin Andujar, but Tommy Herr was a key cog to that whole team. Charlie Huff was, for the longest of times, the only star player for the Texas Rangers in the mid-1980s. It mentions here, throws a knuckler approximately 80% of the time. That may be a completely made-up number, but it may be close to accurate. That was probably the biggest no-duh fact that the Fleer people could put together. Charlie Huff, also the pitcher who gave up Reggie Jackson's third home run in Game 6 of the 1977 World Series, and the opening day pitcher for the Florida Marlins in their first game in 1993. Talked about Ivan De Jesus. It mentions here in the Did You Know, he has never missed a game in his major league career on account of injury. Of course, that is what he is less known for. He was a very good shortstop, but since he was traded for Ryan Sandberg, that is often looked at as one of the most lopsided deals in major league history. Bruce Eggs Benedict, another fan favorite of the Atlanta Braves, still involved with the Braves, I believe. But it mentions here that his father played pro ball with the Yankees and Cardinals farm teams. And it also mentions he is among baseball's best at throwing out would-be base stealers. Yeah, Bruce Benedict was not known for his bat career at this point in his life, a 261 hitter, not bad, but definitely one of the top defensive catchers in the game. Don Money, I brought up, and this is a great Olin Mills picture of him, an infielder for the Brewers throughout the 1970s, but by this point in time, a designated hitter, but a very long and productive career before the Brewers with the Phillies as well. And he was, you know, before he had a Molitor and Yount and, you know, a couple of the other key players from the Brewers, you know, your top guys were Don Money and Cecil Cooper, a lot of very interesting characters from the 1970s Brewers team. I mentioned Leon Durham, who, of course, made that error in Game 5 of the NLCS that helped the Padres get to the World Series in 1984. Mentions here that he enjoys fishing, bowling, and music. We're assuming not at the same time. Speaking of 84 Padres, Tim Flannery, I thought this was a fascinating stat here. Missed batting title at Reno by 1/10,000th of a point with a .350 average. Also mentions that he was called out on strikes only twice all season in 1982. Now, he only had 379 at-bats, but only two strikeouts. Not too shabby, at least being called out on strikes, not swinging away at strikes. Harold Baines, as I mentioned, one of those players from, you know, kind of lost in the shuffle, especially in Chicago, because the White Sox had a couple of good teams in the 80s. But, you know, they weren't consistently good. And then he would go on to play in Texas and a few other places kind of under the radar. But an incredible athlete, and he had a very lengthy career, and a guy that often goes overlooked. Dave Winfield, I joke that he was the seagull killer. He did accidentally kill a seagull with a warm-up toss in the 1983 season, actually got arrested for that. Of course, they take their animal rights very seriously in Toronto. It mentions on his card here a very well-known fact about Dave Winfield. He went straight to the major leagues right after finishing up his education at the University of Minnesota in 1973. Of course, drafted by the Padres, never played a game in the minor leagues. Frank Viola, good old Frankie V from Long Island, would find a lot more success with the New York Mets later on in his career. But You know, another underrated pitcher. He certainly wasn't a fireballer, wasn't a very crafty pitcher, threw a lot of junk at the plate. But more often than not, it turned out to be rather helpful to him and his teams. Rick Sutcliffe, as I mentioned, would find much more fame and fortune with the Chicago Cubs than the Cleveland Indians. Also, I remember him very well for his drunken color commentary with Matt Viskersian on a San Diego Padres broadcast back in like 2005 or 2006. The story goes, Sutcliffe was out golfing with Bill Murray. So, I mean, right there. That's trouble right there. You're spending a day on the course with Bill Murray. You're not having Diet Coke. And boy, I remember listening to that just thinking, this guy is three sheets to the wind. My goodness. He's talking about George Clooney and the Congress. Not one of Rick Sutcliffe's finer moments. Robin Yount, speaking of great players from the Milwaukee Brewers, like we were talking about Don Money a little earlier, mentions here he enjoys motorcycling, golfing, and fishing. That's why he was so popular in Milwaukee. He was one of them, without a doubt. Dave Steeb, you already know I was a huge fan of his, still am. And he started his career as an outfielder. It mentions it here, of course, at Southern Illinois. A Saluki was drafted as an outfielder. Wasn't a real impressive outfielder, but came in to pitch one game while he was in college, and the Blue Jays absolutely loved him as a pitcher and turned him into a pitcher after drafting him. And one of the best pitchers of the 1980s, not just for the Blue Jays, but in all of Major League Baseball. And finally, speaking of position players turned pitchers, bet you didn't know this, but Alejandro Peña, our final card in the pack, was a third baseman who became a pitcher. He had a pretty good arm. So starting in 1979, the Dodgers were able to move him onto the mound. And Peña had a very long career. He was pitching into the early 90s, if I recall correctly. So very smart move for both of the respective teams, the Dodgers and Peña and the Blue Jays. And Dave Steeb. Well, there we go. It's been a fun show. A lot of great points brought up from you about how to get kids involved in the hobby a little more often. So hopefully we can now practice what we preach, get kids involved in the hobby and keep them involved in the hobby with some of those great suggestions that you had. It was a lot of fun looking at the 84 Fleer and 86 Tops. Again, next week, we will take our medicine and force ourselves to open up some junk wax from 1988. So we will post the poll on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains this upcoming Monday. And we encourage you to vote in that. Basically help us pick our poison that we will look at next week. And as I mentioned before, over the next few weeks, we will be introducing some looks at some vintage cards from the 1940s and 50s, also a couple of scheduled guests, and again, some more PAX breaks. So, or PAX breaks. PAX breaks, he said at the end of the long podcast. Well, I'm going to shut up here before I really start to having diarrhea of the mouth. If you would like to help us with throat lozenges or wax purchases, again, you can make a cash donation to paypal.me/waxecstatic. We do appreciate all donations we have received, and we certainly hope we can get a donation from you as well to keep the podcast going nice and strong throughout the summer and hopefully beyond. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll talk to you next week.